"Do go on," Oliphant urged. "This is uncommonly interesting." "I'm afraid I can't," Mallory said. "The lady in question was a personage."
"Your discretion, sir," Oliphant said evenly, "does you credit as a gentleman. A knife attack, however, is a serious crime. Have you not informed the police?"
"No," Mallory said, savouring Oliphant's contained agitation. "The lady again, you see. I feared to compromise her."
"Perhaps," Oliphant suggested, "it was all a charade, calculated to involve you in a supposed gambling brawl. Something similar was worked on Rudwick, who died, you will recall, in a ratting den."
"Sir," Mallory said, "the lady was none other than Ada Byron."
Oliphant stiffened.
"The Prime Minister's daughter?" "There is no other."
"Indubitably," Oliphant said, a sudden brittle lightness in his tone. "It does strike me, though, that there are any number of women who resemble Lady Ada, a queen of engines being a queen of fashion as well. Thousands of women follow her mode."
"I've never been introduced, Mr. Oliphant, but I've seen her in Royal Society sessions. I've heard her lecture on engine mathematics. I am not mistaken."
Oliphant took a leather notebook from his jacket, propped it against one knee, and uncapped a reservoir pen.
"Tell me, please, about this incident."
"In strictest confidence?"
"You have my word."
Mallory presented a discreet version of the facts. He described Ada's tormentors and the circumstances to the best of his ability, but he made no mention of the wooden case with its French engine cards of camphorated cellulose. Mallory considered this a private matter between the lady and himself. She had burdened him with the guardianship of this strange object of hers, and he regarded this as a sacred obligation. The wooden case of cards, carefully wrapped in white specimen linen, lay hidden among the plastered fossils in one of Mallory's private lockers at the Museum of Practical Geology, awaiting his further attention. Oliphant closed his notebook, put away his pen, and signalled the waiter for drinks. The waiter, recognizing Mallory, brought him a Hucklebuff. Oliphant had a pink gin.
"I would like you to meet some friends of mine," Oliphant said. "The Central Statistics Bureau maintain extensive files on the criminal classes, anthropometric measurements, engine portraits, and so forth. I should like you to try to identify your assailant and his female accomplice."
"Very well," Mallory said.
"You shall be assigned police protection as well."
"Protection?"
"Not a common policeman, of course. Someone from the Special Bureau. They are very discreet."
"I can't have some copper tagging always at my heels," Mallory said. "What would people say?"
"I worry rather more what they'll say if you were to be found gutted in some passage. Two prominent dinosaur savants, the both of them mysteriously murdered. The press would run quite wild."
"I need no guard. I'm not frightened of the little pimp."
"He may well be unimportant. We shall at least know that if you are able to identify him."
Oliphant sighed delicately.
"No doubt it's all a very trumpery affair, according to the standards of empire, but I should reckon it as including the command of money, the services, when needed, of that shady sort of Englishman who lives in the byways of foreign life in London, and lastly, the secret sympathy of American refugees, fled here from the wars that convulse that continent."
"And you imagine that Lady Ada has fallen somehow into this dire business?"
"No, sir, none of it. You may rest assured that that cannot possibly be the case. The woman you saw cannot have been Ada Byron."
"Then I regard the matter as settled," Mallory said. "If you were to tell me Lady Ada's interests were at hazard, I might agree to almost any measure. As things stand, I shall take my own chances."
"The decision is entirely yours, of course," Oliphant said coolly. "And perhaps it is still early in the game to take such stern measures. You have my card? Let me know how matters develop."
"I will."
Oliphant stood.
"And remember, should anyone ask, that today we have discussed nothing more than the affairs of the Geographical Society."
"You've yet to tell me the name of your own employers, Mr. Oliphant, your true employers."
Oliphant soberly shook his long head.
"Such knowledge never profits, sir. There is nothing but grief in such questions. If you're wise, Dr. Mallory, you'll have nothing more to do with dark lanterns. With luck, the whole affair will simply come to nothing in the end, and will fade away without trace, as a nightmare does. I shall certainly put your name forward for the Geographical, as I have promised, and I do hope that you will seriously consider my proposal regarding possible uses of the Bow Street engines."
Mallory watched as this extraordinary personage rose, turned, and strode away across the palace's rich carpet, his long legs flashing like scissors. Clutching his new valise with one hand, the overhead straps with another, Mallory inched his way along the crowded aisle of the omnibus to the rattling exit platform. When the driver slowed for a filthy tarmac wagon, Mallory jumped for the curb. Despite his best efforts, Mallory had boarded the wrong bus. Or perhaps he had ridden too far on the correct vehicle, well past his destination while engrossed in the latest number of the Westminster Review. He'd purchased the magazine because it carried an article of Oliphant's, a witty post-mortem on the conduct of the Crimean War. Oliphant, it developed, was something of an expert on the Crimean region, having published his The Russian Shores of the Black Sea a full year prior to the outbreak of hostilities. The book detailed a jolly but quite extensive Crimean holiday which Oliphant had undertaken. To Mallory's newly alerted eye, Oliphant's latest article bristled with sly insinuation. A street Arab whipped with a broom of twigs at the pavement before Mallory's feet. The boy glanced up, puzzled.
"Pardon, Gav?"
Mallory realized with an unhappy start that he'd been talking to himself, standing there in rapt abstraction, muttering aloud over Oliphant's deviousness. The boy, grasping at Mallory's attention, did a back somersault. Mallory tossed him tuppence, turned at random, and walked away, shortly discovering himself in Leicester Square, its gravel walks and formal gardens an excellent place to be robbed or ambushed, especially at night, for the streets about featured theatres, pantos, and magic lantern houses. Crossing Whitcombe, then Oxenden, he found himself in Haymarket. Strange in the broad summer daylight, its raucous whores absent now and sleeping. He walked the length of it for curiosity's sake. It looked very different by day, shabby and tired of itself. At length, noting Mallory's pace, a pimp approached him, offering a packet of French letters, sure armour against the ladies' fever. Mallory bought them, dropping the packet into his valise. Turning left, he marched into the chuffing racket of busy Pall Mall, the wide macadam lined by the black iron palings of exclusive clubs, their marbled fronts set well back from the street jostle. Off Pall Mall, at the far end of Waterloo Place, stood the Duke of York's memorial. The grand old Duke of York, who had 10,000 men, was a distant, soot-blackened effigy now, his rotund column dwarfed by the steel-spired headquarters of the Royal Society. Mallory had his bearings now. He tramped the elevated pedestrian bridge over Pall Mall, while below him sweating kerchief-headed navvies ripped at the intersection with a banging steel-armed excavator. They were preparing the foundation of a new monument, he saw, doubtless to the glory of the Crimean victory. He strode up Regent Street to the circus, where the crowd poured endlessly forth from the underground's sooty marble exits. He allowed himself to be swept into swift currents of humanity. There was a potent stench here, a cloacal reek, like burning vinegar. And for a moment Mallory imagined that this miasma emanated from the crowd itself, from the flapping crannies of their coats and shoes. It had a subterranean intensity, some fierce, deep-buried chemistry of hot cinders and septic drippings, and now he realized that it must be pistoned out somehow, forced from the hot bowels of London by the charging trains below. Then he was being jostled up Jermyn Street, and in a moment he was smelling the heady wares of Paxton and Whitfield's cheese emporium. Hurrying across Duke Street, the stench forgotten, he paused below the wrought-iron lamps of the Cavendish Hotel, secured the fastenings of his valise, then crossed to his destination, the Museum of Practical Geology. It was an imposing, sturdy, fortress-like edifice. Mallory thought it much like the mind of its curator. He trotted up the steps into a welcome, stony chill. Signing the leather-bound visitor's book with a flourish, he strode on into the vast central hall, its walls lined with shining glass-fronted cabinets of rich mahogany. Light poured down from the great cupola of steel and glass, where a lone cleaner dangled now in his shackled harness, polishing one pane after another in what Mallory supposed would amount to an unending rota. On the museum's ground floor were displayed the vertebrata, along with various pertinent illustrations of the marvels of stratigraphical geology. Above, in a railed and pillared gallery, were a series of smaller cabinets containing the invertebrata. The day's crowd was of gratifying size, with surprising numbers of women and children, including an entire uniformed class of scruffy, working-class schoolboys from some government academy. They studied the cabinets with grave attention, aided by red-jacketed guides. Mallory ducked through a tall, unmarked door and down a hall flanked by locked storerooms. At the hall's end, a single magisterial voice was audible through the closed door of the curator's office. Mallory knocked, then listened, smiling, as the voice completed a particularly orotund rhetorical period.
"Enter!"
rang the voice of the curator. Mallory stepped inside as Thomas Henry Huxley rose to greet him. They shook hands. Huxley had been dictating to his secretary, a bespectacled young man with the look of an ambitious graduate student.
"That will be all for now, Harris,"
Huxley said.
"Send in Mr. Reeks, please, with his sketches of the Brontosaurus."
The secretary tucked his pencilled notes into a leather folio and left, with a bow to Mallory.
"Have you been, Ned?"
Huxley looked Mallory up and down with a narrow-set, pitilessly observant eyes that had discovered Huxley's lair in the root of the human hair.
"You look very well indeed. One might even say splendid." "Had a bit of luck,"
Mallory said gruffly. To Mallory's surprise, he saw a small, fair-haired boy, neatly dressed in a flat-collared suit and knee-breeches, emerge from behind Huxley's heaped desk.
"And who is this?"
Mallory said.
"Futurity!" Huxley quipped, bending to pick up the child. "My son, Noel, come to help his father today. Say how do you do to Dr. Mallory, son?"
"How do you do, Mr. Mallory?"
the boy piped.
"Dr. Mallory,"
Huxley corrected gently. Noel's eyes widened.
"Are you a medical doctor, Mr. Mallory?"
The thought clearly alarmed him.
"Why, you could scarcely walk when last we met, Master Noel,"
Mallory boomed heartily.
"And here you are today, quite the little gentleman."
He knew that Huxley doted on the child.
"How's your baby brother, then?"
"He has a sister now as well,"
Huxley announced, setting the boy down.
"Since you were in Wyoming?"
"You must be happy at that, Master Noel."
The little boy smiled briefly, with guarded politeness. He hopped up into his father's chair. Mallory set his valise atop a bookcase, which contained a Morocco-bound set of the works of Cuvier in the original.
"I have an item that may interest you, Thomas," he said, opening his valise. "A gift for you from the Cheyenne."
Remembering to tuck the French letters beneath the Westminster Review, he brought out a string-tied paper bundle and carried it to Huxley.
"I hope this isn't one of those ethnographical curios," Huxley said, smiling, as he parted the string neatly with a paper knife. "I can't abide those wretched beads and whatnot."
The paper held six shriveled brown wafers, the size of half-crowns.
"A helpful bequest to you from a Cheyenne medicine man, Thomas."
"Rather like our Anglican bishops, are they?"
Huxley smiled, holding one of the leathery objects to the light.
"Dried vegetable matter. A cactus?"
"I would think so.
Joseph Hooker of Kew could tell us.
This witch-doctor chap had a fair grasp of the purpose of our expedition. He fancied that we meant to revivify the dead monster here in England. He said that these wafers would enable you to journey far, Thomas, and fetch back the creature's soul."
"And what do I do, Ned? String them on a rosary?"
"No, Thomas, you eat them.
You eat them, chant, beat drums, and dance like a dervish until you fall down in a fit. That's the standard methodology, I take it?"
Mallory chuckled.
"Certain vegetable toxins have the quality of producing visions,"
Huxley remarked, putting the wafers carefully away in a desk drawer.
"Thank you, Ned. I'll see they're properly catalogued later. I fear the pressure of business has confounded our Mr. Reeks. He is usually more prompt."
"It's a good crowd out there today," Mallory offered to fill the silence.
Huxley's boy had pulled a toffee from his pocket and was unwrapping it with surgical precision.
"Yes," Huxley said. "Britain's museums are fortresses of intellect, as the PM puts it in his eloquent way. Still, no use denying that education, mass education, is the single great work at hand. Though there are days when I would throw it all over, Ned, to be a field man like yourself again."
"You're needed here, Thomas."
"So they tell me," Huxley said. "I do try to get out once a year. Wales, mostly. Tramp the hills. It restores the soul."
He paused.
"Did you know I'm up for a lordship?"
"No," Mallory cried, delighted. Tom Huxley, a lord. Struth, what splendid news! Huxley looked unexpectedly morose.
I saw Lord Forbes at the Royal Society.
Well, Forbes said, I'm glad to tell you are all right for the House of Lords. The selection was made on Friday night, and I hear that you were one of those selected.
Huxley, without apparent effort, had Forbes's gestures, his phrasing, even his tone of voice. He glanced up.
I haven't seen the list, but the authority of Forbes is such that I feel somewhat assured.
Of course, Mallory exulted. A stout fellow, Forbes.
I shan't feel entirely certain until I receive official confirmation, Huxley said. I confess, Ned, to some anxiety about it. The health of the Prime Minister being what it is.
Yes, a pity he's ill, Mallory said. But why should that concern you so? Your accomplishments speak for themselves. Huxley shook his head.
The timing seems no accident. I suspect this is some ploy of Babbage and his elite cronies, a last attempt to back the Lords with scientific savants while Byron still holds sway.
That's a dark suspicion, Mallory said. You were evolution's greatest advocate in debate. Why question your good fortune? It seems to me a matter of simple justice. Huxley grasped his own lapels two-handed, a gesture of deep sincerity.
Whether I have the lordship or not, I can say one thing. I have left my case to stand on its own strength. I have never asked for special favour. If the title is mine, it is not through any intrigue of my own.
Intrigue does not enter into it, Mallory said.
Of course it does, Huxley snapped. Though you'll not hear me say it publicly, he lowered his voice. But you and I have known each other many years now. I count you as an ally, Ned, and a friend of truth.
Huxley began to pace the Turkish carpet before his desk.
It is no use our having any false modesty about a matter so important. We have certain vital duties to perform, to ourselves, to the outside world, and to science. We swallow praise, which is no great pleasure, and endure multitudinous difficulties involving a good deal of unquestionable pain. Pain, and even danger.
Mallory was unsettled, taken aback both by the speed of the news and the sudden weight of Huxley's sincerity. Yet Huxley had always been like this, he thought. Even as a young student, there had been a shock and an impetus to the man's company. For the first time since Canada, Mallory felt himself back in his true world, in the cleaner, higher plane that Huxley's mind inhabited.
"Danger of what kind?" he asked belatedly. "Moral danger. Physical danger as well. There is always hazard in the struggle for worldly power. A lordship is a political post. Party and government, Ned. Money and law. Temptation. Perhaps ignoble compromise. The nation's resources are finite. Competition is sharp. The niche of science and education must be defended, nay, expanded."
Huxley smiled grimly.
"Somehow we must grasp the nettle. The alternative would be to lie still and let the devil have his way with the world to come. And I, for one, should rather burst to pieces than see science prostituted."
Startled by Huxley's bluntness, Mallory glanced at the little boy who was sucking his toffee and kicking his bright, shiny shoes against the chair legs.
"You're the man for the task, Thomas," Mallory said. "You know that you may have whatever help I can offer if the cause ever needs me." "It cheers me to hear that, Ned. I do trust in your strength of heart, your stubborn fixity of purpose. Proved true as steel, 2 years' hard labour in the Wyoming wilderness. Why, there are men I see every week who claim great devotion to science, yet dream of nothing but gold medals and professors' caps."
Huxley was pacing faster.
"An abominable blur of cant, of humbug and self-seeking surrounds everything in England today."
Huxley stopped dead.
"That is to say, Ned, that I sometimes suppose that I myself am tainted, the possibility of which I hold in morbid dread."
"Never," Mallory assured him.
"It's good to have you back among us," Huxley said, resuming his pacing. "And famous, better yet. We must capitalize on that advantage. You must write a travel book, a thorough account of your exploits."
"Odd that you should mention that," Mallory said. "I have just such a book here in my bag, The Mission to China and Japan by Lawrence Oliphant. A very clever chap, it seems."
"Oliphant, the geographical? Man's a hopeless case.
too clever by half and lies like a politician. No, I propose a popular rendition, something a mechanic can understand. The sort of chap who furnishes his sitting-room with a Pembroke table and a crockery shepherd and shepherdess. I tell you, Ned, that it's vital to the great work. Good money in it as well."
Mallory was taken aback.